In this episode of the Critical Myth crew plays the game with defiance, contemplates karma with True Blood, drops a bomb with Manhattan, begs for mercy with Crossbones, gets disturbed with the leftovers, and finishes out the week with this week's Quick Hits. It's episode 472, Castathon Cosplay.
What's that? That's right. We are back with episode 472 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we still have...
Edmund from Greenville, and trying to avoid 40 lashes.
I'm Gary from Jacksonville, and I'm learning more and more never to scorn a woman.
Indeed. All right, well, before we get into our usual stuff, just to give us a little bit of an opening here, I thought that I would just check in on some of the highlights tonight, as we're recording on Saturday of the weekend that Guardians of the Galaxy is out in the theaters. I just thought that this was a little bit funny. You know how that this film was always a bit of an underdog to many people, and at first they said, yeah, it's probably going to make around, you know, $50 million in its opening weekend.
It's got a talking raccoon for crying out loud.
Yeah, exactly. And then they said, no, you know what, it's actually trending more towards $60. And then this week, as it was getting ready to go, they said, no, maybe it's trending towards $70. Well, after just the Friday opened with about as much money as Serenity made in its entire run, it is now on course for over $90 million for its debut. This would put it above Captain America the Winter Soldier. Just putting it into perspective, folks. Mm-hmm. This little movie that could, that everybody was saying, what? What were they thinking about? What were they thinking putting this out? This is never going to fly. Well, there we go.
Yep.
Yeah, you can never quite tell.
Yeah, you know, and while I think there may be a slight element there of it's up against scant competition, but I think as well, it's just been they've been hyping it, and people have been seeing the trailers and the word of mouth coming out of previews and things. This just really did turn into something that people are very interested to go see.
Yes.
And we should stay through the credits for this one, too, right? They won't let us ever leave early again. We have to watch every grabber, yes. Food services person.
Yep.
The
production babies. Mm-hmm. Some of the other ones I've seen over the years as I've had to start watching all these credits.
Not to mention just the thousands of FX people, presumably all sitting in front of keyboards and monitors and whacking away.
In Taiwan or somewhere, or Thailand, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll give them this much. Marvel not only came up with a great way to tie all their content together in order to create this monster of a franchise, but they've found a way to get the mass audiences to sit through the credits. Good for them. I mean, because some of the after-credit scenes really aren't that monumental, but damn if people don't sit and wait just to see what happens.
For heaven's sakes, the Avengers were sitting in a diner eating some
shawarma
or something. Yeah, and you're like, oh wow, I can't wait to see. Oh, they're sitting down eating. Yeah, okay.
Well, I'm just waiting for the inevitable time when Nick Fury comes out and recruits the audience to the Avengers Initiative. But at any rate, we're going to go ahead then and continue with this week's content, our usual episodic rundown. But first, we're going to have to do a little thing called our spoiler disclaimer.
Absolutely. We might discuss just about anything that might have happened in these episodes, so if you haven't seen them, you will be spoiled. But it's been a week or so we certainly hope you've had a chance to catch up.
That's right. And Gary, I believe it is actually your turn to pick our next topic.
All right. I will say, we'll stay on Earth, but let's go a little into the future and talk about Defiance.
All right, and here is the promo.
There she is, All units, be advised, an active Galani is in the vicinity. It's highly lethal.
It doesn't know the war's over. We're humans. Enemy combatants.
Defiance, all new next Thursday at 8, only on Sci-Fi.
And if you could do the recap, please.
Absolutely, we're talking about Defiance. Season 2, Episode 6, This Woman's Work. An Arcfall crash salvage mission led by Nolan leads to danger in the form of an alien race he has never encountered before. At the same time, Stama makes a shocking power play after she's admonished by church elders for her growing sense of female empowerment, and Arissa begins confessing her deep, dark secrets to Tommy.
Yes, that's one way of putting it, I suppose. All right, and what would you give this episode, do you think?
I would give it a 7.
A 7, okay. And how about you, Edmund?
I'll go 7.5.
All right, and I went 8.
Look at that. 8? Why did you go 8, John?
Well, I'll tell you in just a moment after I'm done logging in all of our scores. Patience. All right, well, I've been pretty much on this kick all season long. I've enjoyed the progression of all the various plot lines and so forth. The one that really got me this time around was this whole idea that Stama is fighting her culture in a lot of different ways. And it's not something that's new. It's been going on all season, but I love watching her get won over on the patriarchy. It's just fun, because she does it so well. And it's one thing when it's Daytac, but it's another thing entirely when it's just the culture in general. And it's good to see that struggle taking place and her kind of making it very clear that in order to survive and to thrive in their new situation, the Kassathins are going to have to change the way that they do things. Meanwhile, we've got this very interesting new wrinkle that they threw in here, and I don't remember seeing this before, but it's going to be just a disaster, is the only way I can put it. And from the character point of view, apparently there are clubs in Defiance and probably elsewhere where humans dress up as the alien of their choice and for all intent and purposes, role play.
Mm-hmm.
And you get the sense that a lot of it is for dating of various types, but that it's not just that. It's more of this weird thing where humans are kind of like appropriating the things that they admire about these aliens, and it's like getting into another species' skin for a while, and it's really creepy.
Yeah, I was scratching my head at that one. I just couldn't make hide nor hair of it, especially when they were actually talking in language as well. I was like, whoa.
Yeah,
I mean, I've seen cosplay, but that's really
yeah. That's getting extreme, right? And yeah. I can definitely see Christy doing it in order to, at least in her mind, she's trying to evoke some bit of Stama's strength as a female. But I can just imagine how that would be interpreted. Again, as the word appropriation comes to mind, that it would be seen almost as an insult, even as Stama is saying that they need to incorporate things from human culture if they're going to survive and move past the problems of their previous existence and live on Earth. They're going to have to do this. And it's kind of odd that they're throwing this out there and saying that you might agree that the Kassathins need to start acting more like humans and stop with their old traditions and find a new way to live. Yet the humans are kind of doing that with the alien stuff, and it really feels wrong, just plain wrong, especially since the mayor, or the acting mayor, who clearly is all about taking whatever he wants from the aliens and using it for his own advantage, that's even more worrisome, because what the heck is he doing there?
Yeah, I think that was the element that really pushed it into that creepier realm. If it had just been Christy dressing up as a Castie to try and understand her family better, and I think the DJ who was pushing her into that certainly seem to have some ulterior motives as well about sort of getting her into that lifestyle. But what really made the difference was having the Chancellor indulging as well, because certainly having William Atherton playing that role and getting to just take such relish in donning that other skin, just his performance alone just really conveyed so much about this whole fetish basically that people have been getting into. But yeah, that was a delightfully creepy thing that they were introducing.
Well, then match that, at least in my mind, thematically with Eriza in her own way introducing alien something into other people against their will.
Yeah.
And you've got this whole spectrum of exploring this whole idea of this continuum between human and alien. And, of course, that leads into quite a bit of material involving Berlin and some rather nice German borders. But, yeah, I mean, you've just got everybody kind of in a mess right here. The one thing that let me down, and I'm curious, is because Gary, you kind of mentioned this before, that whenever this crept into the show, it always felt like it was kind of forced in, and I felt that more in this episode than ever, was the aliens that Mercado sent Pettinger and Nolan out to go effectively, you know, capture for Earth Republic use. Those aliens were right out of the video game, and boy, did it ever feel that way.
Yes.
Oh, very much so. And just to go against the whole teaser, Nolan knew exactly what the creature was.
Yeah.
Why didn't you tell me it was one of those?
Mm-hmm.
Those? They're real dangerous. We need to make this particular weapon up now. I'm thinking to myself, it felt like they were playing a video game exactly. You know, go grab power up unit one and combine with power unit two to create, stopping weapon. I was like, okay, I didn't think they were going to quite go back this heavy towards the game as they had been. It felt like they were going away from that for so long. I was disappointed to see it go that way. More importantly, I was a little surprised that the person who they said was tracking this ship for 19 years was not more prepared. You know, it seemed a little, oh yeah, we're going to go, we've been tracking this for so long because it's going to provide us with power, and we have no equipment or anything to deal with, to deal with them. It just struck me as a little odd with nearly two decades to prepare that, you know, it seems like they cobbled together a team at the last minute.
Mm. Yeah, just a little bit. Edmund, how about you? Your take on?
Yeah, no, I mean that was completely the element that just. What wasn't working for me was having the gameplay just come back full force, although it did amuse me that there is still this issue of, yes, they're trying to incorporate these things, but they don't have a huge budget, so it's one of these nice creatures that's all energy, so they don't actually have to show too much, I was amused at the there did seem to be a little bit of a shout out to a Fantastic Planet going on, that aside, I'm going back to some of the stuff with Eriza, what let me down there was while the stuff with Christie and Mercado and the whole alien club, I thought was very well done. That whole thing of Eriza and Tommy then just stuck in that container waiting for this guy to wake up just seemed like a very strange choice of trying to advance that plot and evoke, you know, they weren't really evoking much tension, it just felt like the episode just would kind of grind to a halt during those elements, during those sections. Yeah,
I would have almost seen it working as some sort of standoff, like, you know, Tommy had his gun and Eriza had something else, and, you know, she's like, no, just wait, you know that type of sort of scenario. But yeah, they were just like kicking back on the couch and you're like, okay, he's still convinced that you killed him and he's still not doing anything. So even if he did revoke his law status, it seems odd that they, as you said, it stretched out for so long.
Maybe it's the Defiance version of Waiting for Godot. I don't know.
Waiting for Erzu, yes.
Yes, that's it. But yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where one side of the episode with all the character exploration to me was working out really nicely. I even feel like to a degree that was at least playing that the side with Tommy and Erizo was at least playing on their past, at least somewhat. And then you had this nonsense with the game footage. At least it really felt like they took an asset right out of the CGI for the game and just used it right on the show.
Hey, we can save you some money. We're just going to plop the feed right in.
That's right. Yeah. And it just didn't work for me. It was way too obvious that they were just playing with it in that regard. But what can you do? All right. Anything more to say on Defiance?
No.
Okay. Then let's go ahead then and move on, as usual, for our new format to one of the quick hits. And I'm going to pick here one that... we can probably go through relatively quickly, and that's The Lottery, Season 1, Episode 2, Rules of the Games. Rules of the Games, yeah, okay. Allison faces the aftermath of her actions. Vanessa, Darius, and the president's advisors debate the next steps of the lottery. Meanwhile, Kyle and Elvis seek refuge with an old friend until Elvis suffers a diabetic attack that puts his life in danger and threatens to expose them. All right, and I believe that Edmund, you're the other one watching this show.
Yep.
All right, and what would you give this one?
I think I would give this one 7.
All right, yeah, I'm still okay with that. I mean, it's an average rating, but it's still a fairly average start to the show. I like the fact that they're not trying to push the premise too quickly; they're letting it build.
Mm-hmm.
And I do also like some of the implications of how they're using politics and being very sinister in the way that they're doing these things, but it also is kind of revealing the desperation that one would expect in this situation. So they're playing it the way that they should be playing it, but it's still lacking a bit of energy. And I think that's where it's kind of still not quite there for me yet.
Yeah, definitely, and there are certain things that aren't quite tracking for me. Since they made a big point about there is that Elvis is one of six kids that age. The fact that they can run off and hide away with one. What, one of the other say, you know, the little girl who is one of the other five, I should say, and that would actually work. Just it didn't quite track. So yeah, especially if there's this much, they're generating this much attention and fugitives, and so yeah, that just seemed a little too easy, and wouldn't they be keeping better tabs on the other five? So yeah, that really reeked of being a little too convenient.
Mm. Yeah, like I said, they have to work on a few things here and there if they want to get above an average rating. But it's not the dire show that I think a lot of people were expecting from Lifetime after that Witches of East End show came out. That's for sure. All right, well, that being the case, let's go ahead then and move on to, I guess you could say, one of our major topics. And Edmund, it's your choice next.
Let's see. Well, this would be me taking a time out, but why don't you and Gary tell us about True Blood?
Sounds good to me. Let's go ahead then and run the promo.
Never seen Hep V do that before.
What stage you in?
I began to notice last night.
I'm gonna tell Violet. I gotta break it off.
Violet?
Hey, baby. I wanted to surprise you.
I can still sense Phil. He's in my blood.
Adeline!
Time until dawn. Our first sunrise together.
And Gary, why don't you do the recap for this one, if you don't
Absolutely.
Mind.
Oh, sure, no problem. We're talking about True Blood, Season 7, Episode 6, Karma. Eric and Pam find a new ally in their search for a common enemy. Sookie makes a startling discovery that forces her to rethink her recent involvement with Bill. Lafayette shares a vision with Letty Mae. Jason realizes how he really feels about Violet. And Sam mulls a startling admission from Nicole.
Okay. And what would you give this one?
I will give it a 7.5.
All right. Nadim gave it an 8.5, and I'll give it an 8. Well, Gary, what are your thoughts on this one to begin with? I guess the question is, the last couple episodes I think you were a little more favorable towards.
Yeah. They don't really mention it in this episode, and I don't think I'm ahead. So I will say the Eric and Pam part of this episode with finding what is she calling herself now? Mooney? Moon? Anyway, who is it? Sarah, I think it was, that when they find her and now they find out that she has the cure
right.
for the vampire things. Wow, that sort of came out of left field, and the twist in her from a person from the one who caused the problem to being the cure seems a little too fast for me.
It is a little bit fast, and it is a little bit weird, too. But I guess that's one way to convince people to keep you alive, at least for a little while.
Yeah, and that's about what it would have taken, too. Yeah. So, I mean, I suppose in that sense it was appropriate. But at the same time, that's her conversion, for lack of a better term, from vampire hater to savior of the vampire race. I wish I had seen something of it. About the 6 minutes we saw her with her Rajneesh, or I forget what she called him, was just a little bit, as I said, too fast. I didn't see that there was sort of any change other than she was hiding out. So I would have liked to have seen something with that. And then my other negative point before we get to more positive aspects of the show was we find out Bill's Hep V positive, and what's the first thing Sookie thinks? Oh, I better go get tested. Not to get in touch with Bill, not to comfort him.
No, of course not.
You know, it seems so selfish and self-serving to
Wait. What character are we talking about again?
Oh, geez. Even for her, it seemed a bit.
What really took this one down for me wasn't the stuff with Sarah Newland. It was rather the stuff with Lafayette and Letty Mae. I can't stand Letty Mae. We got rid of Tara. Couldn't we have gotten rid of her entire family?
Well, all things said and done, I think that's part of the character. I don't.
Maybe.
She's supposed to be an unsympathetic character. She's supposed to be this.
Well, it worked.
Either current or recovering drug addict that you're not supposed to feel sympathy for. And so, I mean, that's the character as they've always presented her, so it's been consistent. So I was okay with that, but no, I still don't understand that plot line at all.
Yeah, I don't know why they're continuing along those lines. And then, of course, we have the whole thing with Jason and Violet, which I thought she made a good case. But, you know, I can also understand why Jason would still have something for Jessica. So, that I just feel like is going to go into some nasty directions, and at least the writers have done a nice job of showing us that they're not afraid to kill off characters. So maybe they will continue to do that with Violet taking out some of the extended cast. It would certainly be an interesting turn of events.
And I mean, they've done a good job presenting her character as intimidating, scary, and more than willing to, you know, twist somebody's neck off just at the blink of an eye. So with a casual disregard. So, you know, things are wide open. Who knows what she'll do? I mean, yeah. As soon as he was back with, as soon as Jason started fooling around, it's like, what's Violet going to do to him? How bad's mm-hmm. it going to be? You know, we were already thinking that before she even made her attempt to, I don't know what you'd call that, her last-ditch effort to try and swoon him back. So I was always, what's she going to do to him? You know, before, you know, when he was walking back in, I was expecting a violent response. So, you know, they have us well conditioned. So I'm curious to see if they will play to expectations or do something else.
Exactly. All right. I don't know what else is there to really say about this episode. Do you have any other items?
I enjoyed the comical nature of the law office.
Oh, yes.
It seemed very surreal, almost Beetlejuice-esque in the waiting room aspect, yes, where you have all these sort of odd, freakish things, and everybody's just casually sitting there waiting.
Yeah, with the ticket, it definitely it evoked a lot of Beetlejuice. Of course, Beetlejuice didn't threaten the lawyer, but maybe that's just their twist. So let's go ahead then, and I think that we can probably do a mid-show break here. And when we come back, we'll see what our next topic is going to be, so stay tuned.
If I close my eyes, will it come to life? Is it something I'm dreaming of? If a steady head doesn't rule my heart, will it lead me to somewhere happy enough? Now I'm a sore soul in a sinful
now that we're back from our mid-show break, I think I actually want to go ahead with a new show that's out, a little bit of a quick hit to check in on this one, and that is Manhattan, Season 1, Episode 1, You Always Hurt the Ones You Love, a drama about the clandestine race to build the world's first atomic bomb in Los Alamos, New Mexico, centers on a self-destructive professor who is commissioned to help lead the Manhattan Project in the series opener. Okay, so I believe we all got a chance to check in on this one. Gary, what would you give it?
Well, I want to give it points for not being titled pilot. But that aside, I'd give it an 8.
Okay. Edmund?
I will go 8.5.
All right, and I'm going to go 7.5. All right, well, all above average to one degree or another. Gary, just briefly your thoughts on it.
Okay, well, I was a little surprised it wasn't a Sex and the City follow-up series, but I typically enjoy these the genre, this sort of mid-40s wartime era, and I enjoy seeing it more from the scientist's point of view. I've seen a bunch of these movies over the years concerning this exact same topic, and it always seems to be military based or narrowed down to one single scientist. So I enjoyed the more of the cast approach to this, where we're seeing different aspects of the whole situation, the security apparatus, as well as the difficulties people are having. I they're painting a very broad picture with this, and I hope they continue that because I'm really enjoying it. It's not so much even the atomic history; it's the character interaction that I liked a lot. I enjoyed them setting up people who are stuck in this situation, as well as people who want to be here. So I'm enjoying the different nuances that they're getting across the not just the performances, but that the actors have to present as these different struggles to go through. We like to see a lot of flag waving and everything going on, but this was all happening with real people, and in this case, people were moving from all over the country to the middle of the desert, and they were stuck there for years and couldn't really talk to family, having all their communications censored. And, while it developed into a nice sort of town or base over a while, that's not where they're at right now. They're barely into shacks and things like that. So it's a rough situation. Everybody's feeling the deprivations not only of the war, but even more so when these people are pretty much confined to an army base when they didn't enlist. So it's a difficult situation, and I'm enjoying it. I feel they're overplaying the security issue a little bit, but I'm hoping that was a trick pony for this episode and that they'll sort of delve into other things as the series continues.
Hmm. Edmund, how about you?
Yeah, no, well, this certainly for WGN's second offering was a very different from Salem, where they were being much, much campier and more over the top. And this is very much them pushing more for that high quality drama in the veins of, because of the period stuff, people have been saying WGN's Mad Men. But for me, I mean, especially with Thomas Schlamo on board directing the pilot, and there actually being instances of walking and talking going on, it was actually reminding me more of The West Wing, and in the good way of them setting up this large canvas, but focusing in on particular characters, and particularly, as they're saying, the professor who's the main focus, John Benjamin Hickey, doing a fabulous job of conveying the pressures and the conflicts, and also Olivia Williams, former used to be running the Dollhouse over in the Whedonverse, playing his wife. And as Gary was saying, it's not just that they're focusing on the scientists, but also on those family dynamics and the fact that they were all there with their wives, but their wives couldn't be told what was going on, except for whatever speculation they were indulging in among themselves to whatever limited extent they could without getting in trouble with the authorities. And that central couple, having Olivia Williams be an actual biologist and scientist, so someone with compared to some of the other ladies who seem more conventional 40s society types, when we've been talking about in Defiance with Stama trying to stretch the conventions and things, it looks like there may be a little bit of that going on here as well. I was very impressed with this, and especially as someone like Gary, I've seen most of those movies they've made about this, and read various accounts, both first person accounts and Richard Rhodes' fabulous history. It felt very authentic, even though I think that it's in my memory of it, I don't remember the Fat Man bomb, which is the one that which is the project they're working on that is being threatened with cancellation. I don't recall it being quite that much of a conflict, but I think this may be a case of them wanting to increase the dramatic potential for the series, and if they can they can do it kind of the way Masters of Sex has been doing it, where they're playing a little fast and loose with some of the specific details, but in the service of telling the story, I'll be perfectly all right with that.
Yeah, that's the feeling I got as well, Edmund. I was like, I don't remember that much controversy, and they were both moving forward pretty mm-hmm. much not lockstep, but sort of one would take two or three steps in advance, then the other one would catch up type of thing. So that's, they're playing a little loose. So I wouldn't write any term papers off this show, but they're at least staying in the neighborhood of accuracy.
Yeah, exactly. Mm.
I guess the only thing that kind of held me back a little bit was, number one, this isn't the topic that I know an enormous amount of, you know, of the backstory for, but it did feel a little slow as a start. A lot of the characters were there wasn't a lot to them quite yet, other than the you know, basically the two that were at the very forefront. And I guess it just was. It just felt like there needed to be a little bit more energy to what was going on. It was just a bit slow, and yeah, that's probably the one thing that I could say about it. It just didn't really feel like it was. It felt like this belonged more on an AMC than on a basic cable network. And good for them for trying to really do something that has a lot of gravitas to it. But I feel like they're going to have to do something to inject a little bit more energy into it. No pun intended, given the subject matter. But you get the idea that it's like, yeah, they were going for very artistic, and there were some really amazingly well done shots and setups in this episode. I'll give them that. But then there were some conversations that felt like they were stuck in slow motion.
Well, I think it was, this was the initial episode, and I realize there's a lot of world building and character exposition that has to go on. And so I wrote, at least for this episode, I wrote it off as that, because, like I said, you're not showing off, they're not showing the bombs off. They're trying to, show all the people, and it's a fairly large cast. So I figured we were just going to have to deal with this, and there wasn't anybody, oh, you know him, he's from such and such university and his specialty is this, although we did get one of those where the guy was describing himself at least and not someone else doing it for us. So I took it a little bit, and hopefully they've fleshed out the characters enough to start running with them.
Yeah, I realize this was the first episode, and so there is a little bit of pilotitis going on, and keep in mind that I would usually default to about a 6 for a pilot, so giving it a 7.5 is still a nice jump. Mm. It just felt like, maybe it was slowed down by all the exposition, and like you guys were saying, the extent of the just draconian way that things were being done was overplayed a little bit. I got really tired of hearing about how super secretive it was and how dire everything was. I'm sure that was just to reinforce the circumstances, since it was the beginning of the show, and to really get people kind of on board to understand the mindset to a certain degree. But then that was also the part where I was sitting there going, well, the dude's wife that's complaining about, the changes in circumstances and needs to be given a reason why things are the way they are. If it's this dire an attitude among people that are dealing with the wartime stuff, then she's being awfully selfish.
Mm. But actually, John, it was that secretive.
No, I didn't mean secretive. Yeah, I meant the constant reminders of the number of people that are dying and the dread of, oh, we're all going to die. It was like, wow, I get that, this is the tone you're trying to set, but you keep saying it. It's like, okay, good. We all know that. Move on. It just felt a little too repetitive.
This was, 43, I think, when the show opened?
Yes.
Things still were not looking good, in the larger scheme of things. Hitler was still on the offensive. He was doing pretty good. The Japanese were gobbling up, half the Pacific at this point. There was that sense that we were not doing that well in the war at this point yet. Yeah, we had a lot of military losses at this point. Things were just getting ready to turn around, but they hadn't yet. So there was a very persuasive sense that people had to work harder because we're not, you know, we need to do better because things aren't going well. So, I mean, there, obviously I agree they did overplay pretty much anything that was negative in this show to, I guess, give it more gravitas. But no, it's, you know, the basics, as I said, they may play a little loose, but they're still in the neighborhood. It was bad and rough then in 43. It wasn't until, you know, early 44 that people started to think we had a chance, and it wasn't until June of 44 that things started to turn around. So now we're a good year away from things looking up.
Okay, so let's see. The let's go ahead and choose another topic here. And Barry, is there anything else on the list that you really see as a topic you want to cover?
No, I think we've covered everything, and I'll get off my history soapbox now too, as well, for the audience. I'm sure they're a little bored of hearing me go on, but it is a topic near and dear to my heart, so I went on a little bit much. But I think I've covered everything this week.
Okay. So that being the case, I guess we will catch up with you on, I guess, a future episode.
Yes, gentlemen.
Or which one it'll be, the next one or the following, but next week anyway.
Okay. Have a good week, guys.
Yes, you too.
You too.
Crap. Okay. Edmund, if you could go ahead and pick our next topic then.
Well, speaking of international crises, why don't we finish off the day on 24?
I was actually going to hold that one off until we got Bronze Thumb around. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Indulge me a little longer. Hopefully he'll be back next week.
Absolutely. Okay. In that case, why don't we talk about Crossbones?
All right. And if you could do the recap.
Certainly. This is Crossbones Season 1, Episode 7, Beggar Man. Nena plans an escape, putting Lo in peril. Meanwhile, Balfour forms an unlikely alliance that could cost him and Lo their lives.
Yes, and what would you give this one?
I will give this one a 7.5.
All right, and I'm going to go in the same direction. All right, general thoughts on this one?
With this one and with the other, so I mean, this episode did kind of highlight how much the show does revolve around John Malkovich, because this was the episode where he's basically recovering from his nasty surgery, so he's basically spending most of the episode still passed out and dreaming about his past at the hands of Jagger, and so it's leaving Lo and basically having the playing this odd little game with Nena that with her threatening them and them it's like this little game of hide and seek that's going on with the letter that she's trying to conceal I'm not going to say it quite devolved into farce, because there were some significant risks being taken, but it kind of felt like the, you know, certainly quite a bit of the juice was sort of missing from this one, as well, I think what brought it back to a certain extent was with the stuff that was then coming out, where we finally they were really cleaning up some of the plot points and letting us know exactly what Lo had done in the past, as the beggar man spy up in Scotland, and putting down the Jacobites, and that whole revelation that yes, basically he's Lo is the reason why he is crippled, so introducing that whole revenge side of things. The way they wound up resolving it at the end, after going back and forth with Lo being about to be beheaded, and then pulling back from that, and but then with him winding up as the one to take the lashes, and finally serve his penance. That I thought was quite powerful, but just some of the machinations leading up to it just were not really grabbing me.
The thing about this episode that I found a little bit weird was that I understand that they tried to explain how it is that he didn't notice that Lo was the Beggarman guy from Scotland, but it didn't really ring true.
Yeah,
it felt very contrived. And so that really just undermined the entire episode. And it's like, wow, so you wait until this long for why? And then the whole thing of the kind of exchange at the end, where I'll take the lashes for you kind of attitude, just to kind of make up for stuff. It just felt insincere. As insincere as taking 40 lashes can be. But yeah, it just didn't really work for me. And I think it all came down to, like you said, when Malkovich is off the screen and isn't involved in what's going on, the show loses momentum.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes perfect sense in that regard for the show to be effectively, at this point, just spooling out the remaining episodes.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not that I'm just hoping that it all resolves, and maybe this is what this episode is supposed to be, is the beginning of the resolution to at least this series. I know that it wasn't necessarily billed as a limited series, but I'm sure that they were smart enough to not pull an Under the Dome and at least give it some degree of closure. We'll find out, because as we speak, the last two episodes have run. So we'll find out soon enough. All right, let's go ahead then and move on to another one of the quick hits over here. And did you happen to watch the episode of The Musketeers that I have on the list?
I've watched half of it.
Watched half of it? Ah, okay.
Yes.
Well, you can speak to that half then. The Musketeers, Season 1, Episode 4, The Good Soldier. Aramis' old friend, Marsac, a former musketeer, unexpectedly returns to Paris, and his arrival throws the musketeers into turmoil. They know they should report him for desertion, but his appearance coincides with the royal visit of the king's sister and her husband, the Duke of Savoy, whom the musketeers must protect. All right. Well, I don't know that it's fair for you to ask you to give a score to half of an episode, but was there a particular issue that you had with it?
No. I mean, basically, I mean, I've seen the setup, so I know that yes, it's the whole question of the circumstances under which this musketeer deserted, and the reason why he's taking the pot shot at the Duke of Savoy at the beginning is because apparently it's the Duke played a major role in that, and certainly the fact that the Duke of Savoy is being played by Vincent Regan, who's one of my favorite actors in current times, so I always enjoy his work. I think I may have mentioned at some point he was actually he was one of the few reasons to watch the Prisoner remake other than Ian McKellen. In terms of what I saw, I liked what we were getting in terms of after some of the personal backstory we had in the previous episode. This is now getting more into the regimental history, but still also playing with the issues of loyalty and friendship and who's scheming against who. So I enjoyed the setup, and I'm interested, certainly very interested, to see which way it plays out.
And I'd say that there's a twist still to come that is one of the reasons that I gave this one an 8 out of 10.
Okay.
And I liked it quite a bit.
Yeah.
All right, well, we're going to go ahead then and cover one of the last major topics that we have here on our list, and that would be The Leftovers. And here's the promo.
Following a catastrophic event, the incidence of delusion rise dramatically. The Prophet's Dilemma. What happens when those conversations with God go wrong?
We are, all of us, no matter what we've suffered, still alive.
I guess I should be scared, but I'm not.
I don't know what's happening to me. I did something stupid.
You lost someone?
I lost everyone.
The lucky ones, they get to stay sane.
I am not gonna lose my mind.
What's happening to all of us?
It won't be long now.
You're okay.
All right, and if you could do the recap, please.
Certainly. This is The Leftovers, Season 1, Episode 5, Gladys. A vicious hate crime tests Laurie's resolve. Kevin mauls an outside offer for help to rid Mapleton of its problems. Matt takes his sermon to the street, and Meg assumes a new role.
All right, and what would you give this one?
I will give this one an 8.
An 8, okay, and I will go with a 7.5.
Okay.
All right. And, why an 8 for this one?
The major event, they open the episode with is this stoning of one of the guilty remnant, which was quite brutally depicted, really making sure you viscerally felt each of those hits, I liked the way they use that as a way of further exploring the guilty remnant and also using this unusual event to pull a few little tweaks and tricks, primarily this whole thing of them having to stay at the motel and Laurie at least having the opportunity to take a day off, which of course also meant that Ann Dowd actually, as fabulous as she's been in giving a masterclass in how to act and convey tons of stuff without actually saying anything, did finally give her a chance to actually speak. So, which was give us a little bit more of her background. So I thought that was very nicely done. Then with our police chief there, I was his whole back and forth with trying to get hold of the feds and then that whole offer he gets, and I was actually starting to go back to this whole thing of his mental stability and whether that was something that was actually being offered or if that might have been something that was going on in his head, because he'd like to have that option too, or at least that possibility of getting rid of all his problems that way, because as much as they've been showing things have changed in society as a result of these disappearances, I'm not quite convinced that the feds would have quite gone over to that sort of apparent vigilantism and taking things into their own hands. So we'll have to see whether that is actually a real possibility. And I guess given the way they were going after the cult with Tommy and Christine, I guess that it is a possibility that they're getting that heavy handed. But I like that little note of uncertainty that was giving me again about Kevin's condition. And then sort of on the flip side to and Dowd finally getting to act with words, I did like the at the very end, when Matt does seem to be pulling out of his funk to a certain extent, and his whole taking to the streets outside the Guilty Remnants home, but Laurie still managing to stay within her strictures, making her objections very loudly and firmly felt. I thought interesting stuff going on in the way they're exploring these the ramifications of this world, basically.
Mm. Yeah, this one definitely it kind of spilled itself out from the very beginning, and I guess for me the shock of the beginning it never quite lived up to that.
Mm-hmm.
Not entirely. But I could definitely see how the message at this point is that both the extent of the disturbing nature of the Guilty Remnant and the way that the world is reacting to them is much more intense than perhaps we had been led to believe. And so on that level, at least, the episode succeeded. All right, well, I do think we are just going to go ahead and wrap up the quick hits before we wrap up for the week a little bit early again with only a second show, but that's all right. Let's see. I'm going to go ahead then and cover a couple episodes of Extant, or Extant, as they like to say. I'm not sure exactly that that's the right way to say it, but why does it matter? It really doesn't. No. In this case, we have Season 1, Episode 3, Wish You Were Here. Molly considers telling John about her pregnancy after he confronts her about her distant behavior. Meanwhile, some parents become suspicious of Ethan when he attends school for the first time. All right. Are you up to date on this show, by the way?
Yes.
Okay. Any thoughts on this particular episode? Well, yeah. Let me go ahead and just start. Just my main beef, because I give this one a 6.5. I don't know what you would give it.
I'm probably leaning more towards a 6.
Okay. It felt so weird to consider that Molly would not have told her husband right away.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like she's going to get accused of cheating on him.
Yes.
Where exactly would she have been cheating with anybody? It just mm-hmm. didn't seem like it made much sense. And so much time spent on Ethan and the kids at the school and all of that was just boring as it gets. I mean, Nadim, who gave the first two episodes a pretty high score, gave this one a 6.5.
Mm-hmm.
Or actually, a 6, rather. So it definitely was a big step down from what was a fairly good episode the previous week. Anything to add to that?
No, I mean, that's been that whole thing of her not telling him. It's like, yes, in her head, she feels like she cheated or something happened to her. But as you say, I mean, no, given the circumstances, you know, nobody else is going to think that. So it really felt like just trying to spin out a crisis that didn't need to be there.
Yes. And now, from there we have, Season 1, Episode 4, Shelter. Sparks tries to quarantine Molly, but she and her family flee to a remote island with her estranged father. When the agency closes in on them, Ethan is exposed to grave danger. Meanwhile, Yasumoto experiments with a strange and deadly substance.
Yes.
What would you give this one?
5.5.
Ooh, okay. I would go to a 6 on this one. So this show is rapidly becoming a bit of a disappointment, too.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is the one where, I mean, because it was continuing on from the end of the previous episode where she, Sparks, yeah, is trying to take her away, basically, and she escapes, and her husband has come after them. So, yeah, so now they know something's up, and they're on the run, and, yeah, they just go to see her dad, which, and just on a couple of levels, it was like there was seemed like there was nowhere near enough sense of urgency, and they're doing something where yes, they could easily be found as they were, and then trying to inject this drama of dad as the alcoholic, and that's why they're estranged, and even though it's Lou Gossett Jr. playing dad, it just felt incredibly stilted and wooden and just extremely generic. Again, trying to create some these conflicts, and both in terms of their pursuit and within the family dynamics, that just fell completely flat to me.
There was a little bit of satisfaction having the cattle prod to the back of the kid, though. I mean, that
yes, okay.
it gave a little bit of something to the episode, because I mean, yeah, the what really drove me nuts is that half of the script seemed to be focusing on the dad as a chronic alcoholic. The other half of the scenes with him seemed to imply that he had some kind of memory issue or Alzheimer's that he was dealing with as well. And they never really did anything with it. I don't know if they intend to down the road or something like that, because of course it's Steven Spielberg. So family is a big thing.
Yep.
And once again, it's the Achilles heel. It's not all that surprising that this show is coming in around the same score right now as Falling Skies.
Yes.
But yeah, it's like, okay, so what's the deal with this guy? Is it that he has all these issues because he drinks all the time, or is it because he's got some other things going on? But how pathetic was the freaking bar game that they were playing?
Yes.
I think this is what, come on. At any rate, moving on then to our final topic here, and one I'm sure that you are more than happy to delve into, and that would be Masters of Sex.
Yes. Season 2, Episode 2, Kyrie Liaison. Masters begins a new job at Memorial Hospital under Betty's extortion terms, only to discover that his boss insists he leave Virginia behind in favor of a hand-picked secretary. Meanwhile, Johnson is torn between pressing Masters to rehire her and staying by DePaul's side as her condition worsens. And and this was continuing on from the first episode, another very strong episode. I would I would drop it slightly to a 9 this time, some interesting stuff going on with Masters taking up this new post, and as was certainly strongly hinted with his introduction in the first one, his new boss being a little problematic to work with, also apparently a Breaking Bad fan, because the handpicked secretary is Betty Brandt from Breaking Bad, Getting to play a role where there were always those little comedic elements that she was able to introduce into Breaking Bad, but if anything, one of my criticisms was that they were making the character just a little too broad, I'm hoping that will be pulled back a little bit as the season goes along, because especially in a show where the characterizations have been so spot on and well acted, it just felt a little bit out of left field. And then with what Virginia's dealing with back at their old place of work, interesting the way the way they're playing the DePaul storyline, and her cancer taking much the turn for the worse, where basically has started metastasizing to her brain, so she's not speaking properly, which is bringing up problems as Virginia's trying to get her to do instructional films for pap smears, just not working at all, and that is what it's the classic case of doctors being the worst patients, because she does finally manage to get her to see her oncologist, I can see where they're certainly pushing this along as much as where it's going to bring things to a head as DePaul's condition worsens, and Virginia is really going to need that job. Of course, as I was mentioning with Manhattan, this is a case where yes, we do know they are going to be these leading famous sex researchers within a couple of years. So, but it's just a question of getting it there, and they are still doing a very good job of keeping the dramatic tension going as they move into this next phase.
Mm. Very cool. Yeah, it's good to see that the show at least creatively is continuing to make great strides.
Oh yeah,
I know that. Unfortunately, it's taken a little bit of hit in the ratings, but hopefully that won't matter too much quite yet.
Yeah,
as it is a cable TV show. So
exactly.
All right, that's it for the material that we have for this week. So we're going to go ahead and bow out. So come around next week for another show introduction. Actually, we have another show that is debuting. It's just that kind of summer.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google Plus under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as Fair Use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the critical myth.